You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast, episode 39. This is Ed Song. I am an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. And with me, as always, is Coyle Neal, assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. What is Bolivar like in June, Coyle?
It depends on the year, but summer in Missouri is usually a special kind of hell. It's usually 80s and 90s, 90% humidity. It's awful. For someone who grew up in the mountains in the West, where summers are, you know, 70s with no humidity and it cools down to the low 60s at night, this is just awful. Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of hell, but a special kind of hell.
Yeah, well, it's not like frozen over or anything like that. I assume Santa Barbara is paradise. Like, isn't that one of the the big things about California? Is it's always nice.
You know, it's not just California. My wife actually is going on a writing retreat that the college is sponsoring, and they're driving an hour north of here, but they're going inland. And she looked at the weather report, and it was going to be 90. The deal with Santa Barbara, though, is that it's right on the coast. And there are mountains behind us. In fact, the college, Westmont College, is right in the foothills of the Santa Ynez Mountains, I guess is what it is. And so on this side of the mountain, the annual high basically ranges from the low 60s to the mid to upper 70s. And the annual low ranges from, I don't know, the lower 50s to the lower 60s or something like that. Yeah, so it's basically always in the 60s or 70s. It's kind of idyllic. But if you go over the mountain into the valley, then it turns into 80s and 90s.
Yeah, and that's... I would prefer never to have it be 90 outside. Under any circumstances.
You know, the crazy thing here is that it often feels warmer than it is just because there are never any clouds. Like, there are never any clouds. And so when you're out, there's never any cloud cover, so you're just always in the sun. So it might be 70 degrees, but it kind of feels like it's in the 80s just because you're like a piece of chicken under the lights at Chick-fil-A or something like that. But anyways. So as we've entered into the summer, what are you up to? Have you slipped into summer mode, or what does summer mode look like for you? Are you writing or reading stuff?
I'm trying to. I have two small children, and the wife kind of carries the bulk of that over the semester, so I try to balance that out a little bit in the summer. But yes, preparing for classes is kind of the main thing I do in the summers. Reading the stuff I need to read for class, writing the stuff I need to write for class. I try to do a little bit of extra writing above and beyond that, and extra reading above and beyond that, as time and opportunity permit. And then all of the household stuff that I've let slide during the semester, I have to catch up on all of that, which is really unfortunate because it is nice here in the spring and the fall, which is, you know, when the outdoor stuff should be done, but I don't have time to do it until, you know, June and July.
So this is like weeding and trimming?
Well, that's sort of the stuff that has to be done every week. Mm-hmm. So we just put in a fence. I spent the last week painting the fence, basically, getting up at mm-hmm. like 5:30.
When you say we put in a fence, did you put in the fence?
You know, I didn't. We did it during the semester.
Like,
and again,
a manly Western man?
I wanted to build a fence around our place, but growing up where I grew, the only two kinds of fence I know how to build are barbed wire and electric, and the wife wouldn't let me do either of those. So we had someone come and do it, again, just because I didn't have time during the school year, but I painted it over the past week. So,
Cole, if you're going to put in a fence, you got to put in a fence, you know? You don't want to just put up some white picket fence. You got to put up a fence that's going to keep the intruders.
So someday when I have funds, I will have a 50-foot wall around my house with turrets on the top and the whole shebang, but we don't have the money for that.
Spectacular.
So. And that one I will build myself. How about you? How's your fence coming, Ed?
I'm just sort of trying to figure if I have metaphorical fences in my life.
Well, maybe more broadly, what do you do with your summer?
Yeah, so this past semester has been a particularly busy semester for me. I sort of picked up an extra class at the last minute. So summer, maybe I've said this before, but summer to me is actually busier than the academic year because the kids are out of school. And there's just no structure to our days. They're both going to be starting camps next week, but it's just crazy because it's this mix of running around with the kids and doing fun family stuff, but I miss the structure. But anyways, I'm trying to get caught up on writing and some writing projects. I have a book project that I've been anxious to try to make some progress on. I think the more that I talk about it, the more likely it is to become real, so I'll talk about it. But it's a book on progressive politics for evangelicals, basically. That's I've been thinking about, and that's been really formed by these podcasts. Anyways, so I want to make some headway on that, and otherwise, I picked up all of these books through the course of the semester that I haven't had a chance to get to. Chief of which is Arlie Hochschild's "Strangers in Their Own Land," which I think we have alluded to, but it was one of the great trilogy of books on the white working class that came out this past year. So we did a Hillbilly Elegy episode, and there was another book from a former LSU colleague. What's her name? It's Nancy Isenberg. She wrote a book called White Trash, I think is what that book is called. It's like a history of the white working class in the United States. Anyways, and so I'm going to try to get through the Hochschild book, which my wife has read and is very enthusiastic about, so I'm looking forward to reading that. What's on your reading list for the summer, Cora?
Well, again, in addition to all of the stuff that I have to read to get ready for class in the fall, so books that new editions have come out of that I have to go through and that sort of thing. I have Ben Sasse's new book that I'm reading.
Oh, yeah.
And theoretically going to be reviewing for the blog if I have time to get to it. And then just a big stack of novels that, again, I haven't had time to get to. So I try to catch up on a little bit of science fiction, a little bit of regular nonfiction, a little bit of, you know, I try to read a classic work over every break, just again, as time and opportunity permit. I haven't decided what I'm doing this summer with that. I think over...
Yeah, so it's classic, like... Cicero or Dickens?
It can be. So yeah, more the Dickens sense. So in over the winter break, I read a collected works of Washington Irving, and then the summer break before that, I read, I don't remember what I read now. Oh, I read some Dostoevsky, although I don't remember which one off the top of my head. So the sack of books to read is tall and never seems to get any shorter.
Amen to that. Well, with that said, maybe we should move on to the topic of today's podcast. And as we sit here on the eve of the 4th of July, Coyle and I thought that it would be interesting to have an episode dedicated to patriotism and talking and thinking about patriotism, what patriotism is, how patriotism manifests itself in the United States, and maybe how Christians should think about patriotism and love of country. Cole, do you want to kick us off and maybe say something a little bit about what you think patriotism is?
All right. Thanks, Ed. So, I think there's obviously patriotism is a big word, right? And there's a lot that you can do with it. We had Paul Miller as a guest on the podcast a few months back. He actually gave a talk to my class about patriotism and contrasted it with nationalism. And the distinction that he drew, which I thought was a pretty useful one, is that the nationalist is the sort of person who thinks that their country is always right, always doing a good thing, and should be supported, sort of contradictorily, should be supported right or wrong, which is when they say America right or wrong, what they really mean is America is always right, and I'm always going to be backing them all the way. Whereas patriotism is the idea that someone loves their own nation and wants what's good for it, but is willing to say, look, I want what's good for my country, but sometimes my country does things that are wrong. It makes bad decisions, evil decisions, stupid decisions. And when that comes along, even if I'm disagreeing with what the nation's doing, it's not because I dislike it. It's because I really want something better. I think Chesterton has something like this. I don't remember where it is, but he has a couple of different essays on patriotism where he says something similar, right? Like you would never say, I love my wife, whether she's right or wrong. Like you would say, I love my wife even when she's wrong, and I want what's good for her, even when she's doing mm-hmm. something that I think is incorrect. And in the same way, you would always, as sort of an attachment to that, Chesterton says that patriotism is always very specific. So to use the, and I think he uses this example of again with a spouse. I would never say I love my wife because I love all women and I love the idea of a wife. Therefore, I love my wife. Instead, it's very specific, right? Here is this one person that I am married to with these certain truths about mm-hmm. her. Well, the same thing is true of patriotism, right? I love my country, meaning I want what is good for it. And meaning I love specific things about my country. So I love mm-hmm. The land, I love the people, I love the culture. I love these very tangible, real-world things, not just an abstract idea. The more abstract you are in your patriotism, the less patriotic you actually are in reality. Which means that theoretically you should... sort of love the people who are closer to you more. So as in a nation like the United States, where we have all of these different levels of government, you should probably, as a good patriot, love your town more than you love your state more than you love your country, and then love your country more than you love any other country in the world. I don't know that we always carry that through well, but again, now we're back to, we're not always right. So I would land on some combination of all of those things. Liking the country, loving the country, meaning you want what's good for it, and meaning that you love specific parts of it, not just some abstract idea that only exists in our own heads. What about you, Ed? How would you define patriotism?
Yeah, so I think that's all super helpful. I just think of it in terms of love of one's country. And you made the analogy to love of one's spouse. And in thinking about this, I think analogies to love of family are like very apt and illustrative in a lot of ways. So we have particular attachments to our family. We love our families and want what is good for them. And as you say, that love has a particular object or set of objects, but it's not just generalized. I mean, I suppose one could love families. That sounds a little bit weird, but I mean, think that family is a great thing, but that's not the same thing as loving my family, this family. And, I think that analogy is apt in some ways because it starts to illuminate ways in which that kind of love can be fitting and proper, and what that love attaches to directly, and also what might be pathological about it. So... you know, with regard to love of spouse or love of family, I mean, there are ways in which part of your affection for your spouse or family might just attach to particularities or nuances about them for which you've developed a kind of an affection, you know? So, I mean, it might be foibles, or it might be little eccentricities or things like that, which are really like super particular in nature, or equally it might be attached to the values or commitments that a person has, you know? And then equally we could say about like love of country, there might be particularities about where we live that we really value, just like the landscape, say. But equally, I think a big part of patriotism, it's not, to me, patriotism isn't just that, but states or countries are normative projects. It's like committed to values. And I think part of what patriotism is about is admiring and standing for and valuing the particular norms and mores that the country is built around. And then, you know, equally with regard to pathologies, maybe this gets to the distinction that you were making between patriotism and nationalism. I mean, I would say that that kind of nationalism that you just described, which is it's about blind loyalty to one's country's, thinking that it's the greatest, thinking that it's without flaws, brooking no criticism. You can imagine like the analogy of what that would look like in a family. I mean, to me, true love of my wife and children, and really wanting what's best for them, doesn't mean that the loyalty is blind. Like part of wanting what's best for them is wanting what's best for them. And
right, and so sort of truth and patriotism cannot be separated from each other. And again, I think that's just stealing from Chesterton. As within the family, if I say I love my family because I am perfect and they are perfect, I'm not actually loving my family. I'm loving this thing that doesn't exist in the real world that probably doesn't even exist in my own mind very well. I have to say I love my family with the understanding that here are my strengths and here are my faults. And I'm not going to have a great view on those. You'd have to ask the wife for sort of all of that list. And then the same thing with my wife and with my kids. Here are their strengths. Here are their faults. My affection for them includes all of these different characteristics of them. Same thing with the country, right? Your love for your nation must be based on a true view of the nation. Otherwise, you end up at least being ignorant in your patriotism, and at most being wicked in the application of what that looks like, sort of on the ground. Then you do end up in a sort of might makes right mentality, particularly with regard to other nations.
Yeah, and then you know, another thing that I would say with regard to that and the analogy between the two is that there's an interesting kind of philosophical problem with regard to justifying partiality to certain kinds of groups of relationships. But sort of setting aside that technical philosophical problem, like, I think we can say that like love of family or being in the family relationship justifies a certain kind of partiality to the members of that unit. But but that doesn't mean that you don't have obligations to members outside of that unit, or that no consideration trumps concerns of family.
Right. It doesn't mean you be cruel to others. Right. They are your first and most important obligation, but they're not your only obligation.
Yeah. 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 So I mean, yeah, not even the negative obligation of not harming other people, but the positive obligation to minimally to assist them when they're in need, and to be fair and just. Even if it means in some ways depriving, I don't know, if I'm splitting up a cake between my family and another family, it would be unfair of me to give my family 3/4 of the cake and justify it out of partiality and then giving the other family 1/4. And so sort of, you know, there is a kind of partiality that I think is justified, but it doesn't simply mean that you have no other obligations to people outside of that unit.
Right. No, and I agree. I would want to keep the emphasis, right? The priority is still your family, right? Assuming there is a finite amount of cake in the world, or whatever, you know, food or whatever example you want to use, your obligation is to make sure that your family has some first, and then share the excess. Maybe it means you have less for your family because of, you know, principles of generosity and so on, but your obligation is to make sure your family eats first, and then neighbors, then so on.
So if that's what patriotism is, I mean, patriotism gets at a kind of a loyalty and commitment that is an important part of human life. But then equally, in the real world anyways, it certainly seems, at least to me, that notions of patriotism often become nationalistic and becomes a little bit of a problematic concept. And for me, maybe it's sort of especially with regard to religious conviction. In the United States, which at least historically has a certain kind of religious or Christian heritage woven into its history. There's a way in which religious conviction can be taken in service of nationalist ends that sometimes makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah, let me run a quote by you, Ed. I'll be interested to hear your reaction to this. So this is from a preacher named Billy James Hargis. This was a talk delivered in 1966 at the Anti-Communist Leadership School in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The quote is taken from a book called The Times Were a Changin'. It's a 60s reader by Erwin Unger. So Hargis says, quote, "I believe the Bible is inspired. I believe it's God's word. I believe in heaven and hell. I believe in God and Satan. I believe in right and wrong. I believe God gave us America. I believe America was God's greatest nation under the living sun and the ideal of government. And I believe the only hope to maintain freedom is this Orthodox Christian traditionalist viewpoint. Then you have the anti-communists who say, I would rather be dead than red. And I'm one of those that say, I would rather see my children destroyed and my life destroyed and my wife's life destroyed in a nuclear bombing than the thought of them having to live under a communist slave state. This wouldn't be living. This would be hell on earth, and death would be merciful." And then he goes on, which we probably don't need to do. What do you think?
Wow. So I was following along in that list, and I was trying to figure out the point at which I would depart with those commitments. And I think I got up to, he gave us this country, which I think is true on some notion, but then people might quibble as to what exactly that means. What was the commitment after that?
I think that was the last one.
No. And then, it's the greatest country.
Oh, yeah, it's
the
greatest nation under the living sun and the ideal of governments. And the only hope to maintain freedom is this Orthodox Christian traditionalist viewpoint. And then he goes on to, I'd rather see my, wife and children nuked out of existence than be communists.
Okay. So I think it's safe to say that we both disagree with everything after that.
I think it's...
Now, how about that...
I mean,
how about that bit just before that about whether it requires Christian conviction?
The only hope of maintaining freedom is Orthodox Christian traditional viewpoint. That I don't know that I agree with. I think it certainly helps. And I think we could get into historical arguments about, the influence of Christianity on the origins of liberal ideas of freedom. Mm-hmm. Liberal, little L liberal, right? Sort of Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, mm-hmm. those sorts of things. So there's a historical argument to be made there. I don't think that's the argument he's necessarily making. I think there is, like you said, there's a way in which we could read that. I think from a patriotic perspective, the question is that statement about America is the greatest nation that exists or that ever has existed. Is that an appropriate attitude for a Christian? Mm-hmm. I guess we should probably exclude ancient Israel, given direct government by God and so on. It's interesting. I think on one level I'm okay with that, and if you listeners have listened to the Sectarian Review, I think that by the time this drops, an episode that Danny Anderson and I did on evangelicalism, we'll have some similar discussions in it. But I think there's something to that, given that we are Americans who live in the United States. But I would expect, citizens of any other nation to have the same idea about their own country. So if you're an American...
Really?
So if you're an American Christian, and you think, I'm an American, and America is the place I want to live. The United States is the best country in the world. We could agree or disagree on whether or not you're objectively right. What I would want is to get sort of your admission that if someone lives in the Netherlands and is a Dutch citizen, they believe the same thing about their country, and that's okay. If someone lives in Russia, they believe the same thing about their country, and that's okay too.
Mm-hmm.
So again, as long as there's some idea of patriotism is okay regardless of your country, and excluding countries that engage in active persecution, of course. I don't expect a Christian living in an ISIS-occupied territory to be super excited about ISIS. I get that. But under most normal circumstances, if we sort of export patriotism, if we are patriotic ourselves, I think there should be some understanding that other nations are also patriotic. It doesn't mean I think the idea is right. So, just if you hold that idea, you should be kind of broad-minded with it.
Yeah. I guess, it depends on what you mean by greatest.
Right.
And there's a difference between thinking that your country... I mean, there can't be two greatest nations if greatest means what greatest normally means, right?
And we could get into the objective side of that, right? Is that a right statement or a wrong statement?
Yeah. So if what you mean is that, like, I really love my country, I think it's great, and I wouldn't want to live anywhere else, then certainly, like, lots of people in lots of different places think that. But I'm pretty sure that's not what Billy James Hargis meant when he uttered that quote.
Well, do you disagree with the quote in the sense in which he meant it?
I mean, it depends on what you mean by greatest.
Does it? I mean...
So if by greatest you mean... this is just like any version of the debate in which you're asking whether something is the greatest. Like, who was the greatest football player or who was the greatest rock and roll band? It just depends on what you mean.
Well, right, but I mean, it's also, there are a finite number of countries in the world, and as you pointed out, one of them has to be the greatest. There can't be more than one.
I guess I think that the notion of greatest country, like the notion of the greatest a lot of things, actually makes no sense. So there is no greatest rock and roll band. There is no greatest hamburger. You know, it's just, I don't know if that makes sense.
Why do you hate America, Ed?
But I like Shake Shack hamburgers a lot. Actually, I kind of think that Shake Shack hamburgers are the greatest hamburgers. But so let's set that example aside. But I like America a lot. You know, I think it's a great country, if not a perfect country. I think it is notable. I think it is exceptional. I think all of those things. I don't know if sort of pushing the particular question of greatest makes sense. But certainly, I mean, it makes sense that people the world over are deeply attached to their own countries, and that makes perfect sense.
And that's right to some extent, especially as Christians, right? We should, people who are explicitly commanded to do things like pay your taxes and honor the king and live as obedient citizens so far as we are able, there should be some kind of attachment there.
Okay. So that's interesting. So is it wrong? Is it wrong not to feel that attachment? And like with regard to what you just said, I mean, I don't know that the admonition that we should pay our taxes and respect the governing authorities is the same thing as loving them or having affection for them. And I'm pretty sure that like neither Paul nor Jesus was like, and what I mean is you should love Rome. You should feel affection for Rome. You know, so is it wrong not to feel that kind of patriotism?
Right, and I think part of the problem is this this Hargis quote is coming from a position of terrible theology, right? He's basically mixing up the church and the state and sort of identifying the United States with the kingdom of God,
sure.
I think that's where, a good, robust two kingdoms theology, with all of the problems that theology has, is useful for, we're saying, look, first and foremost, we're Christians. That trumps any nation state we live in anywhere in the world. Right? That's what's most important. Our identity in Christ and as members of a local congregation, that wins out over everything, over city, state, country, all of those things, all other associations. Mm-hmm. To some extent, even over families, right? Our families mm-hmm. won't extend beyond this life, whereas our identity in the church will last forever. So in that ultimate sense, yeah, of course he's completely off, right? He is trying to convince us to be as attached to the nation as we should be attached to the church and to Christ.
So go
ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, but then there is that second kingdom that we are a part of. We are members of mm-hmm. of the state, it's part of the world, right? It's part of the city of man. It's a sinking ship. Whatever nation it is, it doesn't matter. United States or Germany or China or whatever. They're all ships that have giant holes in the bottom that are heading down. But they're still ships that we live in and that we're to be a part of. And I think part of loving our neighbors, part of the command to love our neighbors, when combined with to honor the king, to pray for his good, to pay your taxes, all of those other political commands that we have, does involve a level of affection. It's just a secondary affection, right? It's always really? Going to be a lesser one.
There are actually two things that I want to get to.
Sure.
Let's talk about that thing. So you think that, I mean, maybe to call it an obligation is too strong, but maybe you mean obligation. So you think that there's an obligation to be patriotic then?
Maybe a weak obligation. This on the same level as, you know, what is our obligation to love nature, right? What is our obligation to love sort of the creation and the natural world, which we'll be doing a global warming episode, so we'll have a chance to talk about that a little bit. It's there, but it's secondary, right, to our obligation to love God and love the church.
Yeah, so I would say that the obligation to love and care for creation is sui generis, if only because in Genesis we find the explicit command to abad and shamar, to till and to keep creation, and Adam and Eve are described as being stewards. So I think our obligation to creation is distinct in that way and is really rooted in something explicit that we find in Scripture.
You don't think politics is part of that?
You don't find anything nearly as explicit as Abad and Shamar, right? There's a mandate that is given in creation. And I don't think you find a mandate anything near as explicit as that. And so you are making the point that, so, you know, there are commandments to pay our taxes and to respect our authorities. And then you couple that along with love of neighbor, and you suggested that that equals a secondary an obligation to love our country, albeit a secondary obligation. And I guess it kind of depends on what you mean by secondary obligation. But I think even putting the language that way is too strong. The explicit command is to respect our governing authorities, which I think is certainly distinct from loving them.
So I guess,
and I think our love of neighbor is really quite distinct from sort of love of neighbor has to do with like concern for their welfare, and that really is distinct from that kind of affection for one's country.
So I guess I would look at something like first. So this is 1 Timothy 2, 1 through 4, I guess. First of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings and for all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet mm-hmm. life, godly and dignified mm-hmm. in every way. This is good and it's pleasing mm-hmm. in the sight of God, who desires all people to be saved and to come to knowledge of the truth. So I guess you're arguing that the prayers, intercessions, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings are to some sense like pro forma, right? Separated from affection, and just something
yeah,
that we do
I think
kind of
separated from affection. Yeah, and then especially when you look at the tail end of that, in which it talks about because we desire all to be saved, it looks like the nature of those supplications and thanksgivings is for a peaceable order, such that we can live our lives without interference and so that the gospel can go forth into the world. I mean, so yeah.
I don't disagree with that application. I obviously, that's the point.
And then if you think about it this way, like, Paul is a citizen of Rome, right?
Right.
And he was grateful for that citizenship and called on that citizenship in important times in his life. But it would be weird to say, oh, Paul loved Rome. You know, he had great affection for Rome. He was really critical of certain aspects of it, but he loved Rome.
Well, but we could say he loved the other state he was a member of. He certainly loved the Jewish nation.
Yeah, well, that's different. I, you know, the nation of Israel isn't just a political entity, but it's, I mean, it's the people of God.
Sure. Yeah, and of course you can't separate that out too much, which is why I had to exclude it earlier in terms of what's the greatest nation.
Yeah. You know, so for me, it was, I mean, I don't know if you think of yourself as being a patriotic person. I find notions of patriotism a little bit uncomfortable. So, I mean, I certainly have great affection for our country, and I believe in and admire and support and then committed to its ideals. But to me, especially when you sort of look at the trappings of how patriotism is expressed in public, to me, there's something a little bit weird about venerating the state that almost feels idolatrous to me. So at a sporting event, when we sing the anthem and we take off our hats and put our hands on our hearts, there's something that just feels uncomfortable about that to me, because I kind of feel like it's veneration of the state. Do you have thoughts about that?
So I'm opposed to that in church, just sort of across the board, and we can talk about that, I guess, in a few minutes. In terms of when we're gathered as a civic body, I don't think I object to it, although I respect and I understand and respect the people who do, particularly the Christians who do. So we live in a fairly heavily Amish region, where of course they're not allowed to participate in those sorts of things. That's fine. I can respect that.
They choose not to participate in those things.
Right. Right. And again, I have no particular objection to that, but I also don't object to the Christians who say the Pledge of Allegiance. They don't do it in school anymore, right? You and I did it in like elementary school growing up. I don't think they do anymore.
Oh, they still do it at my kids' school.
Oh, well, good for
them. I
don't
know if they do it every day. I was at a school board meeting where they started with the pledge, and yeah, I felt uncomfortable, I have to say.
Oh, yeah.
And precisely because I'm a Christian. Like, this is why, you know, this is why the Christians were persecuted by the Romans. Like, this is, they died not to do this.
Well, and again, that's you've always got to keep that understanding of, look, this is something that has a very limited scope, right? My allegiance to the United States is real, but it exists in a box that it is not allowed to go beyond, and it's always trying to go beyond it, right? As just part of the city of man, it's always trying to escape and consume everything else. So as Christians, we have to keep those walls around it very solid.
Yeah. So I guess I would say I feel uncomfortable with it. I don't, and certainly there are going to be forms of patriotic or nationalist commitment that I'm going to have really strong objections to. I don't have any in principle objection to the idea of taking off, doffing your cap and saying a pledge and putting your... It's not like I have a in principle... I don't have any formal objection to it, but I have to say it makes me feel uncomfortable. And most of it is for principled theological reasons. But, I mean, the other thing is that... So, you know, you were talking about... we were talking about nationalism earlier. And, I mean, to me, one of the principal things that make nationalist commitment objectionable is that it's primarily used as like a tool of exclusion, as a kind of a test of who's in and who's out. That makes me really uncomfortable. So sometimes it's like those kinds of civic rituals, they often feel a little bit nationalistic to me, right? And it's who's in, who's out, love it or leave it. And that certainly makes me feel uncomfortable. That's nationalism. That's not patriotism.
Oh, and I guess I'm a little more okay with the rituals from sort of a patriotism perspective, because again, singing the national anthem before a game, it's a nice reminder that there is this thing that binds the people there together, that is more important than the game. Right, you have one team and another team. Someone's going to win. Someone's going to lose. Mm-hmm. But there is this thing that's bigger. This thing that both sides are a part of. Obviously, if it's some kind of international game, then that's a little bit different. I don't know exactly what they do. Do they like when what do they do when, you know, some base, when an American team's playing like the Toronto Blue Jays? Do they play both anthems? This will show you how much I watch professional sports.
I mean, I assume that if the game is in Canada, they sing the Canadian anthem. I mean,
right, which is perfectly reasonable, I think. I don't have a problem with the sort of secular rituals, as long as they stay in their place. And that's obviously, to some extent, an individual thing, right? Every individual person singing that has to know, you know, I'm singing this, and it ties me to the person next to me, it ties me to my neighbor. That tie is trumped by my faith, my ties to my church. That tie is in some ways a very, very loose tie that I'm willing to cut if I have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so,
the nationalists would say that's never
that.
To be cut, right? The nationalist is the person who say that nothing is more important. Although, interestingly,
kill me and my children.
Yeah, I mean, nationalism. So I guess one of the things I associate with nationalism is not just an idea of it's my country, right or wrong, but it's usually a very specific view of my country. Right, it's a conservative Republican view of my country, or it's a progressive Democrat view of my country. So the nationalist who says my country right or wrong, who's on the right, usually won't say, well, I guess, you know, we have Obergefell versus Hodges, so gay marriage is the way it is now, so that must be right. Whereas the progressive on the left, who should the Republicans ever get around to getting rid of Obamacare, probably is unlikely to say, well, I guess we got rid of Obamacare, so that's right too, right? It's still.
I wouldn't hold your breath on that. Trump just came out critical of the House bill, but anyways,
right. On Twitter, no less, yeah. So yeah, it's nationalism is not necessarily known for its internal consistency, of course, but it also tends to be kind of ironically very limited in its view, right? It is my country, right or wrong, but when I say my country, I mean X thing that is often not representative of the country as a whole. Whether on the right or on the left, again, the patriot, I think the thoughtful patriot anyway, should be able to say, yeah, my country did this thing that I intensely disagree with. I think it's wrong, but my country does wrong things sometimes, and that happens, and I will still do my best to respect and care for it as best I can.
Yeah, you know, so I don't think I disagree with any of that, and even that bit that you said earlier about, you know, singing the anthem and promoting a kind of a civic bonding. Like, I mean, so I agree. I think civic bonding is a good thing. But, you know, it's interesting. I think one of the things that worries me about it is the extent to which, particularly in the United States, it's so easy for Christian identity to sort of be pulled into this kind of nationalist sentiment, and such that religious conviction and religious identity really becomes a Trojan horse for nationalist sentiment, right? So there's so many people who just think that part of what it is to be a Christian is to be an American, and this particular kind of religio-nationalism. And that's really super disturbing to me. So it's interesting, like, so the Star-Spangled Banner, I'm just trying to think, are there any religious references in the Star-Spangled Banner?
The fourth verse, I think. So the part that we, you know, sing at baseball.
Oh, games, okay. That nobody sings.
Yeah. The parts that we sing, no. The first verse. Let me get the lyrics up here. I was just pulling up another anthem that I think a Christian probably couldn't sing in good conscience. But the verse that we sing in national anthems, no, it's. Pretty straightforward, you know, our country is still there. But the fourth verse, let's see. Thus be it ever, when freemen shall stand between their loved homes and war's desolation, blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven-rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer our must when our cause it is just, and this be our motto, and God is our trust. And the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. I think a Christian can sing that in perfectly good conscience. It's very, very cautious in some ways, right? Let us win if our cause is just. Thank God for preserving us motto is, yeah. And God is our trust. Yeah, that all of that's fine. Our national anthem and most of our patriotic songs don't really commit us to an America sort of right or wrong until we start getting into like the Toby Keith kind of patriotic songs, right? really until the late 20th century, early 21st century stuff. Do we start getting into those?
Yeah. So I don't have any in principle objection to those lyrics, or you think about America, God shed his grace on thee. I don't have any in principle. But again, like to me, those theological references just make me uncomfortable, because there's a way in which it has the tendency of sort of co-opting Christian conviction for the sake of nationalist identity. So it's not like I think it's in principle objectionable, but just in the particular context in which we live. You know, and this is one of the reasons why, like, patriotism in the United States, I don't know if this is entirely true, but it seems like it's true. It just seems qualitatively different than in other countries, or at least in a lot of other countries.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the country, right? So a national anthem that I think a Christian probably should have a little bit of hesitation about singing would be the French national anthem, which I will probably butcher the pronunciation. What's that?
What does the French national anthem say?
So the Marseillaise. So the first verse, "Arise, children of the fatherland, the day of glory has arrived. Against us tyranny's bloody banner is raised. Do you hear in the countryside the roar of those ferocious soldiers? They're coming right into your arms to cut the throats of your sons, your women." And then the chorus, "To arms, citizens, form your battalions. Let's march, let's march. Let an impure blood soak our fields." And then the last verse of it.
Right. So they sing that before soccer games, every time you, or at the Olympics.
I assume
is
so.
Is that what they're saying?
I don't know if they sing the lyrics or if they just play the song. But and then the last verse that is to be sung by children. "We shall enter the military career when our elders are no longer there. There we shall find their dust and the trace of their virtues. Much less keen to survive them than to share their coffins, we shall have the sublime pride of avenging or following them." And then, again, the chorus about soaking the fields with the impure blood of the invader. So,
awesome.
Our national anthem, again, is very restrained in what it has to say.
Yeah.
I'm no, you know, comparative politics expert. I don't know necessarily what patriotism or nationalism in either case looks like in other countries. But I know it can certainly run to extremes everywhere, especially in times of war or national tragedy. Right, that's where the temptation is always there to overreact reasonably, even if wrongly, to overreact and say, well, this awful thing has happened in my country, therefore I have to take the side of my country and not move off of it.
And soak the fields with the enemy's blood.
Right. Well, they've invaded. They have it coming, right? Although I think in that particular case, it wasn't offensive war they were fighting, so.
You know, so you had mentioned earlier this is business about a flag in church. Is there a flag in your church?
You know, I don't.
In your current church?
I'm trying to think. I should have checked last Sunday. I don't think so. Or if there is, I don't believe it's, like, up on the stage.
Right in the center, in front of the
across the pulpit
table.
Right. There's definitely not one there. If there is one,
my pastor before she preaches, she takes the flag and wraps it around herself. Is what we do at my church.
Right. I mean, yeah. I assume like on the 4th of July, many of our church members are wearing like U.S. flag pajamas or something like that. But I
totally.
Yeah. I honestly don't remember. I don't think there is, but again, don't hold me to that. So my previous church and basically all of the churches that I've been in have not had a flag at the front, and most of them have not done like 4th of July or Memorial Day or Veterans Day services or anything like that. So I don't actually know what goes on at one of those, but in my mind, there's like instead of a church service, they sing the national anthem, talk about being, you know, good patriotic Americans, I don't know, eat hot dogs and sacrifice a bald eagle or something like that. I don't know exactly what goes on at these. But it does sort of raise the question of whether or not that's okay. Is there a flag in your church?
Not only is there... Well, so yes is the answer to that question. It's in a pretty... I think there's a California state flag and a U.S. flag. They're in really unobtrusive places.
Right.
They're kind of pushed out to the corners, not even the corners of the... what's the technical church language? The, for...
Like, the nave or the,
Well, no, the nave is, like, the main part of the church. It's sort of like, it's not... The way our church is set up is that there's the altar area, and that's raised, and you sort of... And you can go up, and you can kneel for communion there. So it's not like in that part. It's like... Well, I guess it is in the nave, not in the altar area, pushed all the way out to the sides and kind of obscured by a set of speakers. I think all of the major churches that I've ever belonged to have had flags in them, sometimes a little bit more prominently displayed than others. And, you know, I don't have any kind of huge objection to that. But I guess if I were designing a church from scratch, I don't know that I would put an American flag in it.
Yeah, I sort of do and don't. So if it's there because there's just been an American flag there for, you know, the last 100 years or whatever, and no one even thinks about it, and it's got, like, you know, 46 stars on it or whatever because that's how long it's been there, I don't know that I have a problem with that.
13 stars?
Yeah, I mean, even better, right? But I suspect that if, you know, a new pastor or a new set of elders were to come along and remove that flag, what you would find pretty quickly is that people have thoughts about that, and that's where I think you start to run into theological objections. So I don't I don't agree with sort of the reason behind putting one there in the first place, even though I think most churches today just don't think about it. Right? It's something they've always been doing, and it's there. That's fine. I don't have an objection to that. But when you are thinking about it, hopefully people have serious questions. I feel the same way about, again, a 4th of July service or whatever. You really shouldn't do that.
Yeah, so the church that we went to in graduate school, at the whatever Sunday was closest to the 4th of July, they would sing patriotic hymns. And I can't even remember which ones. But
you know, almost every hymnal has a section of them. And, again, I don't think that's okay either. Yeah, it's one thing to be patriotic. It's another thing to try to fold that into your, you know, congregational worship. Aside from, you know, praying for the church government and so on, that I think is fine. But the most of the patriotic songs that are in church hymnals should not be there.
Yeah. So okay. So with all of that said, Coyle, how will you be spending your 4th of July?
You know, I honestly have no idea. My kids are of such an age, we often don't get to go see fireworks because it's usually after their bedtime. So, like, significantly after their bedtime. So, I don't know. I'm not entirely sure what
we'll
do.
Your kids are young.
Yeah, they're not quite old enough to go. My university has kind of the big community get together for the 4th of July. So we have in the past come over and eaten with friends at the university, just kind of out in the main forum. But then we never get to stay for the stuff. In terms of activities during the day, I have no idea what, if anything, we'll do. How about you?
There is a big fireworks display that goes on in the harbor, and like thousands and thousands of people go down to the beach and sort of watch it. We typically stay up where we are. Again, we're sort of in the foothills of these mountains, and so we'll go up and we kind of see them from, there's a clear view from this mountain road. That's fun.
Do you like I do and take your rifle outside and fire it into the air in celebration of America's birth?
Absolutely, and I try to find as many enemies as I can to shed their blood.
Right. I always hope, like, a drone will fly over my house that day, just so, you know, I can do something.
In any case, so This has been a really interesting episode for me to think through a lot of these issues. In coming out of it, I think I've actually sort of seen a reason to come up with like a picture of like a really appropriate kind of patriotism that's natural and interesting, while also getting a little bit clearer about what it is about patriotism that makes me feel uncomfortable. And I guess, again, for me, just because the temptation in the United States in particular to co-opt religious conviction for the sake of nationalist purposes is so great, it just makes me super uncomfortable. So this has been helpful. This has been a good conversation for me, though I don't know if it means that the next time I'm at a baseball game, I'm going to break out into a really elaborate display of patriotic feeling.
Right.
But anyways.
Well, baseball games are kind of boring, so I don't know that you have to do that there. And I realize I've just offended many of our listeners, and that's fine. You can send us emails
and
yell at me.
The monster truck rally.
You know, I've not been to one of those since I was, I don't know, probably 14 or 15, so I don't remember.
Uh-huh.
I'd imagine they
Well, whatever else you want to say about a monster truck rally, I don't think you could say it was uninteresting.
That's probably true.
Okay, so listeners, go forth and enjoy your hot dogs, and thanks for listening to another episode of the City of Man podcast. We are proud to be members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is the very patriotic Kristen Filippik. You can reach us and shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com, or even better, you can go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, right on our wall. We love to get questions and interact with our listeners there. And as always, maybe especially on the eve of the 4th of July, let me remind everyone to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.